Welcome to the Engaged Midwife Podcast. This is Kara.
And this is Missy.
Hi, Miss.
Hi, Kara. Hello. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's been a busy, busy spring.
And you are outside chilling on your patio, which is so fun.
My favorite place in the entire world.
It's too cold here to be on my patio.
Oh, no, it's really nice. The only problem is that I just have to make sure that I don't miss any doses of Zyrtec. So,
welcome to pollen season.
Yeah, yeah. So you've been busy too. I know we missed a week of our podcast, but we're back. We're back and ready with a really good episode today.
We haven't forgotten our listeners. You have not been forgotten. We're here for you.
No, and what we're doing some topics that some different learners have told us that they want, students have wanted. So I'm pretty excited about this one because I know very, very little. I'm excited to learn from you and our guest.
So what are we talking about today, Kara?
We're going to talk about amniotic fluid embolism or AFE.
Like scary as shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Really scary.
I phoned a friend.
Exactly. That's the best thing to do when you're scared.
Well, also, what was the game show that you could, that was like the option, like phone a friend? Anyway.
Oh, yeah.
But that ages us probably because that was a million years ago. But yes, I phoned a friend and it's a friend of mine. And I'm going to give you a really nice introduction. Linda Johnson, she's a midwife. She currently works with me at Vanderbilt. She is an incredible wealth of knowledge. I learn something from her all the time. She was in private practice in Albuquerque and at the University of New Mexico and then at Parkland. And now she's living with us at Vanderbilt. And I hope she stays there for a very, very long time. So welcome, Linda.
And that was Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is what you were trying to think of.
So good.
I was thinking
it aged us. It aged us because I couldn't remember.
Oh, don't worry. I'm aging you all out. But yes, thank you for having me so much. It's such an honor to be here with y'all.
So I invited Linda and found a friend because I know that she has had some experience with this topic in a variety of settings. And I'm hoping that as we go through some of the information about AFE and about inclusion, exclusion criteria, and what we see in practice, that we can really gain something from her clinical knowledge and from her, you know, working with different teams, you know, in different settings, right? And of people who've experienced AFE.
Yeah, I've been a midwife since 1994, so it'll be 30 years coming up this year, and I've delivered probably over 5,000 babies, but unfortunately, I've had 3 AFEs, so it's kind of a mind-boggling thought that I've experienced 3, because I think many people in their professional lifespan don't ever see it. You know, it's so rare, and it's so terrible, so catastrophic. Yeah.
Well, Kara and I are both at almost 20 years, and I have never had one. Kara either, right?
I was going over, you know, when I went to school, we talked about the 12 OB emergencies. I don't know if you guys use that term for the 12 emergencies, but they always talked about, you'll never see this one. And it's like number 9, AFE, you know, that kind of thing. And I was like, great. And here we are. I've seen it.
That is wild. Well, and I just, as you were talking, I was wanting to look up the incidents because I'm like, well, maybe 3 in 5,000. No.
It's oh, like no. Yeah.
2 in 100,000. So you have had enough for quite a few midwives put together.
Yeah, I've seen some quotes of 1 in 40,000. Yeah, which I think is pretty much that translation. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also interesting too. And when we talk about OB emergencies, and we don't want to scare like our midwife students who are listening or our new midwives who are very much our audience, but it's really something to be prepared for and understand what teamwork looks like. And we have some literature that we're going to talk about today as well. But I do think that like on high estimates, the fatality rate for AFE is around 50%. Although what's interesting is in another article that I was reviewing, it says it's probably more getting closer to like 20 or 25% now because we understand it a bit more and we're, you know, doing more things that I think save women's lives.
Yeah, I do think we are so much more prepared for any kind of like cardiovascular or cardiopulmonary collapse when people are in labor. And because we're getting, you know, we have a sicker audience, right? I think the United States is a little bit unhealthier than we used to be. But I also think now a lot of level three hospitals have like MTP protocols and a rapid response team. You can do a bedside echo at, you know, and see if there is a PE, like see if the right ventricle is collapsing. You know, there's always like improvements in CPR. I just think for all those reasons, it's, we have ECMO now, you know, there's lots of great things that I think have helped with that mortality rate, but the morbidity rate's still bad. Like a lot of people still have neurodeficits afterwards, right? So that's really a sad outcome.
It is. Should we really quickly, just for our listeners, Miss, go through kind of the diagnostic, diagnostic criteria of AFE and then get a little bit more into the experience? Okay.
Sure.
Well, a really good resource is the Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine, or SMFM. Those are our perinatology friends. And consistent in diagnosis is sudden hypoxia and hypotension, followed by coagulopathy or DIC, and it all occurs within relation to labor and delivery. So people will talk about sudden cardiac collapse, hypotension, and then that subsequent DIC. And one of the really interesting things is that a lot of people have kind of this aura or prodrome, a sense of dread right beforehand, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, I've seen a patient with a PE as well. And I think that also happens with pulmonary embolism as well, is that impending doom of that something's wrong, you know?
When someone tells you they feel like they're going to die, you should trust them.
I worked in the ED before I went to labor and delivery, and a charge nurse told me that when I was a very young nurse. If somebody tells you that they feel like they're going to die, they're going to die. And it did. This woman said, you know, I think I'm going to die. And literally she like went into a rest like right there in the ED. And I was like, there you have it. I will always believe somebody now who tells me that they think they're going to die.
I want to make the differentiation though, because, you know, we've got students listening, and I've had patients come into the office and tell me, I'm really scared of labor. My mother, mm-hmm. my great grandmother died in labor. You know, that kind of anxiety and kind of fear that seems kind of chronic and before labor is a little bit different than somebody who's actively in labor and has this acute reaction of, something's wrong. I can't breathe. I think I'm going to die. Like that is a different thing. And I want to make sure we differentiate between the two and honor both, but I would honor both in different ways, right? So I would counsel someone to get off the Google with the first one, if it's in the office. And certainly if someone says it to me and they're in labor, you know, you're going to slap that blood pressure cuff on, that O2 on, mm-hmm. you know, make sure you've got your team close by, and just kind of watch your O2 sats real closely and your blood pressure, right? So,
yeah, it's a good point that you bring up. I want to mention also that 70% of the time the AFE occurs during labor, 11% of the time after a vaginal delivery, and then 19% of the time during or after a cesarean section. So I think we oftentimes think of that AFE event like right after delivery, but it can be during labor as well. And so that's important to take note of. And there's not really any risk factors. I mean, other than it's so rare, thankfully, but as we increase, you know, different comorbid conditions and so forth, those patients just aren't as well overall. But there's not really any truly linked conditions that set someone up as high risk.
Important for us to think about when we were just talking about sort of diagnostic criteria is that it's very much a clinical diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Because even when they've done like post-mortem studies on women, they don't really, it's hard to find evidence of AFE even post-mortem. It's not a diagnosis that is, it's not like we can, you know, draw a lab and it's automatically going to tell us that somebody had an AFE, right? It's very much a diagnosis of exclusion of all of the other things that it could have been. And I also think it's worth noting that the pathophysiology really looks like what Linda said earlier, is like right ventricular failure leading to that like pulmonary hypertension, respiratory collapse, DIC, and there are atypical presentations of AFE. So what we're really talking about is that classic. It has all this, you know, all of these sort of what I would call checklist items for what an AFE looks like. And I think if you understand some of those things, and anybody who's got a critical care background would, you know like if you understand the pathophysiology, then we do a better job of treating it, right? We do a better job of understanding what the steps are. And in this case, it's just like ACLS, right? With ACLS, it's the number of minutes that it takes you to achieve stability, right? And that really plays into how what outcomes look like. And we have a case, I think, that's in one of these articles that I think is worth talking about as well. But did you want to add anything, Kara?
No, it is called an amniotic fluid embolism. And historically, they used to think that it was because some of the fetal cells and amniotic fluid got into maternal circulation and you have like this, you know, inflammatory response. But they don't always find that on autopsy. And they think that, you know, there is some amount of fluid and fetal cells that end up in every pregnant person's circulation from the delivery process. And not everyone has this type of response. And so it's just fascinating the more that we've learned. And we're going to talk about some new protocols, but it has a lot to do with serotonin. It has a lot to do with just different clotting factors and so forth. But we don't truly know exactly what causes this.
We think it's kind of like an anaphylactic reaction. And I think that's why it causes so many multiple organ system failures. You know what I mean? And it's that's why one of the reasons why it's so insidious. And I think a lot of times in person, it mimics a PE, right? It looks like the patient might have just had a PE, and it's really hard to differentiate. And I remember standing in the room with a couple of physicians while we were resuscitating this patient, and they said the difference is with ASE, they'll go into DIC right away. And sure enough, she did. So we kind of diagnosed her pretty quickly, just, you know, because she went into DSC so fast.
That's a great point. Also, like, I was just getting ready to add that sometimes they refer to like what happens with AFE as a cytokine storm, which is very much like, because there's an antigen that induces a reaction, that's what causes some of this collapse. And then, you know, each one of these like subsequent steps in what happens in a patient with AFE. So that's interesting that you just said that, because I didn't even plant it there. It was just already there.
I read your mind.
She knows all the things.
Well, I want to hear a bit about Linda's experience. So I think that's probably, you know, we can talk through treatment algorithms and we can talk about all of those different things, but I'm wondering what the lived experience of the midwife provider is like when a patient experiences this.
Yeah, I guess I want to talk about my three AFEs, but I want to start out by saying, and this is one of the things that we did in our debrief, I want to start by saying that midwives are first responders, right? And I don't think we really talk about that very much. We think of first responders as being, you know, firefighters or policemen or EMTs or paramedics, because we're already in the hospital. But the person that's probably going to be at the bedside when this cardiopulmonary collapse happens is probably going to be the midwife with the L&D nurse, right? So, and that's what happened in all three cases, is I was in there pushing with two of those patients and one patient was in labor. So that's the first thing. And then, of course, it's very traumatic. So at the end of all this, I would love to talk about support and making sure midwives know that there's support out there, because it is a lot to live through when you have to witness that, especially if mom or baby dies, and especially if you have to do a perimortem C-section right there in the room. It's a lot. It's a lot. In two of the cases, both of the women were pushing. They were sitting up, they were in second stage, and they were pushing. And one of them looked at me and said, "Something's terribly wrong." And then she pretty much just coded. So I pulled the baby out with a vacuum because I was licensed to do that at that facility. And the second one, she just became unresponsive. And her husband said, "I think she's having a seizure." And I went around and did sternal rub and she was unresponsive. And that's when we called a rapid. And she was complete. And they came in and pulled the baby out with forceps. So in both of those cases, I think that's why they survived. They did not go back for a C-section. And the first one, unfortunately, was only 4 centimeters. And of course, they had to section that baby out and she died because she went into DIC and basically they couldn't get the bleeding under control, right? So, yeah, so it was in both of these women's favors that they were complete and in second stage. And that's what really made a difference. But it's not hesitating to call a rapid no matter what. That's the first thing, is something's wrong. You feel like something's wrong. Ignore everyone else in the room. Here I had this husband saying, "Oh, I think she's having a seizure." And it's like, no, no, no. no, she's unresponsive, meaning she has no heart rate. So let's go. And so it's really important to kind of be blind to everyone else in the room and really focus and trust what you see.
That's a really good point, Linda. As I was reading some of the different case scenarios, it talked a lot about tonic-clonic looking seizure activity. And I think it's the hypoxia, probably. But that can throw people off just a smidge with that sudden
cough. And I read that some people have like cough and dyspnea as well, right? So it's like, wow, you would think it would be more catastrophic than that. And then, of course, that leads to something catastrophic. But yeah, definitely something wrong. I read an article where it talked about if her O2s are less than 90%, if her systolic blood pressure is 90 or below with no diastolic, it's time. It's time.
We're kind of sitting here stunned, just thinking of, I mean, I'm guessing, Missy, you're probably like me putting yourself in that situation. But it's a really good point that you raised, Linda, about you just have to jump into action quickly. And it's the same ABCs of whatever the cause is, right? We have to maintain an airway and breathing and circulation.
Right.
I was also reading in preparation for this. And it's just a point I want to make in general about healthcare and like about the things that we do in these emergent situations is that like the research right now is saying that the CPR that we're doing is actually really low quality. We're not doing great high quality CPR. And I just want to say across any obstetric emergency that you think you have to do CPR, one of the things that's going to save people's lives is high quality CPR. So it's no interruption in compressions more than 10 seconds. It's like literally just enough time for you to switch, right? With the correct chest compression depth, right? And then adequate ventilation that goes along with that. But I remember back in the day, we were really worried about this coordinated CPR where it was like this many compressions to this many breaths, right? Now we're very much in this like CPR situation where we're just like compressing all the time. It's what we're doing. We're ensuring some sort of blood flow. So it was very evident in the literature that I was reading about AFE that high quality CPR needs to be a really super important first step. And I think everybody like kind of rolls their eyes and they think, of course we're doing high quality CPR. Well, no, we're not. And that's why a lot of EDs have gone to these Lucas devices, right? That are the automated devices for doing compressions, because we know we get better quality CPR with something like that. So when we think about CPR, nobody wants to think about doing CPR on a pregnant person, but it will happen. It does happen. And we need to be considering what kind of CPR we're doing. So, you know, that's really the first step, right? Is figuring out this cardiovascular collapse and then providing those first steps in our ABCs. And one of those is high quality CPR.
Missy, did they talk about uterine displacement to the left at all when you were looking at CPR in obstetrics?
Yes, it absolutely did. And really,
I think that's what makes it hard. Yeah. I think that's what makes it hard.
Is trying to keep the uterus like off of the major vessels in the back. Yeah. I think it would be hard. It's hard to do CPR anyway. It's even harder to do it with a patient at an angle.
Exactly. And it was hard. I do remember that. And we did want to displace, and I was making sure that that was still in the literature because I think it makes a huge difference, but it really makes it hard to get a good depth with your compression, right?
I feel like I always want to say at this point that we don't do CPR on living people. So, you know, while we want to do really good CPR, anything that you do in a quick response is going to be better than not responding at all.
I also think that begs for more SIMS, another SIM class on AFE and running a code. Because I think we do so many SIM classes on postpartum hemorrhage and shoulder dystocia, but a SIM class, I mean, if Rapid doesn't get there for 5 minutes, that's 5 minutes that you know, by that time, and they get there, you got to take the baby out. So I feel like if we did enough SIM at least once a year to remind ourselves about how to run a code when there's nobody there to run a code, but OB people, you know, because it's not something we do very often. And it's kind of nice to do once a year, kind of reminder of what that feels like physically, what it looks like, what it feels like to be in that kind of adrenaline rush and getting it done and trying to be thorough and trying to be detail oriented, right?
Yeah, I think so many of us get it like, oh, this is one more step we have to do. Thankfully, we take care of young, healthy people. They never code until that one time that they do. And you have to be prepared.
I also would like to point out that because Linda was talking about, well, by the time the rapid team gets there, that the baby has to get out. I just want to like make a point to our listeners that the research will show you that a baby will acutely decompensate after 8 minutes of having like a terminal D cell. That's when they start to have neurologic effects. It's 8 minutes. And in the case of AFE, they say that if a mom has had cardiovascular collapse and you are actively doing CPR, that you need to have the baby out in 4 minutes, which is why Linda said, if they don't show up for 5 minutes, you already need to have had the baby out. So, I mean, I challenge anybody to set a timer and see how quickly 4 minutes goes by in the context of any kind of emergency. It goes by so fast. And that's why we need to be thinking in a coordinated manner. And like Linda was saying, I think the SIMS and like repetitive action of doing things so that when it does happen, you have the right response is going to be really important. And, you know, it might save babies' lives, moms' lives.
I was always trained that, you know, girls don't learn how to hit. And so you should always do a self-defense class. So you learn what it's like to really full force come at somebody who's padded and can take it. You know what I mean? And it's kind of fun, but it's also really helpful to feel what that really feels like. And I think it's similar here. It's like in obstetrics, we're not intensivists, right? We don't do this kind of work very often like they do in the ICU every day. But I do think with drills and with SIMS, it can get under your skin and become second nature. And that's really important.
So let's talk some, I think, about what the other supportive things that we do are, Kara. I think that would be helpful just for people to start thinking about. We already talked about ABCs, right? Managing airway, breathing, and circulation. It's the same as with any other code. You need somebody keeping track of the time, right? I need to know when it's been 1 minute. I need to know when it's been 2 minutes, right? Then by the minute sort of countdown for like understanding how we're marking time in these events. And then again, if a patient doesn't have a pulse in 4 minutes, you have to get their baby out if you have any hope of saving their baby.
Yeah, that's what I had read as well, is start by 4 minutes, baby out by five. So this is not the slow, like cauterizing every step of the way down to get baby. It's very quick. And delivery may actually help mom as well. So it's not just to rescue baby, but also may improve the resuscitation that we're doing for mom as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And then I think the next thing we have to think about is, like we were talking about, is that DIC, right? What's going to happen? And the problem with doing a cesarean when somebody doesn't have a pulse is like the quick onset of DIC that happens in patients who have AFE. And so what do we do to you know, fix that problem? And one of the things is making sure we have that massive transfusion protocol. Now, what's interesting is AFE is not hypovolemic. So we have to be careful about how much fluid we give patients because we don't want to fluid overload them, right? So in terms of like blood products, like looking at cryo and looking at FFP and not, you know, overdoing like crystalloid fluids.
I thought that was one of the most interesting things as well, is that really think about using your blood products as your volume, because you don't want the excess. It could actually make the problem even worse if you're diluting the fluid that make the clotting factors even less effective.
The things that is they have a bedside echo, right? So they come into the room during recess and they throw that emergency bedside portable echo on her chest and on her, you know, thorax, and you can see if there's a PE. So that's one way of saying, oh my gosh, diagnosis of exclusion, there's no PE. I don't see an embolism. I don't see emboli in her pulmonary artery. So then you go and you look at the right ventricle and you see that it's starting to fail. You see that it's starting to collapse. And then you know it's an AFE. And that's how you know not to fluid overload them, because you don't have a right ventricle that's working for that fluid. So that's when you pull back on your fluid overload for sure.
I also think it's fascinating. And I wonder if this is one of the reasons why, you know, we're getting better in saving women, is that this idea of having an echo and being able to recognize right-sided heart failure almost immediately, right? And are able to like intervene with things that make sense for that part of the diagnosis. It's so fascinating to me.
Yeah. I think I wanted to go back talking about the role of the midwife, because when the team gets there, like you're doing chest compressions and you called a rapid, and in our system, we also have to call an obit because they don't necessarily hear the rapid being called throughout the entire floor. So you want to call the obit and get the OB team there as well. But once the rapid team gets there and you can stop compressions and they take over the whole resuscitation, there is so much more to do. And what I heard during that whole episode from a lot of different residents was, I didn't know what to do. I didn't feel useful because the rapid team was there. Well, there's like 17,000 things you could do. You know, you have to have one person who goes and gets a Bakri and or a Jada system, uterotonics, because you know DSC is going to kick right in. You have to start an MTP protocol and get a runner, get a nurse to go down and start bringing that blood up, because you're going to need, you know, platelets and FFP and, you know, RBCs immediately. You need somebody, you know, just to like, go get uterotonics. You need somebody to organize documentation. You need somebody to go get forceps if you can pull the baby from below. You need a nurse to have to usher the family out and sit with them and be supportive of them and explain to them what's going on, or at least give them support if you don't know what's going on. Like, there's so many roles for nurses and residents and midwives once the team comes. It's not like something that, you know, you have to kind of just run out of the room because you're not helpful. There's a lot of stuff. Putting in orders is huge. Putting in orders for labs, putting in orders for meds, all those things is so helpful, just to kind of get the ball rolling, you know?
Yeah. I've also been the midwife on the floor when a massive transfusion protocol was initiated. And I felt like I could also just manage the rest of the floor. So being available, they don't necessarily have to be involved in that patient's case. You outlined all of the ways they could be, but also just being ready to step in if anyone else needs care, because your team is going to be pulled. Your resources are going to be.
Yeah, exactly. And what happened in the most recent case that I had was the OB team was doing a stat section in the OR, and we had just finished board sign out. We didn't know this patient. I just walked in her room because I saw she was having D cells and she was a multip, so I assumed she was complete. She had pushed twice and then coded. So the OB team did not know her. We did not know her. So the other role of the midwife is to make sure that when the docs come in, you say, this is a 38-year-old, grab it a 3 para 2. She's coding. She's complete. I think you can pull the baby out with forceps. She still has a heart rate, but no pulse. I think she blew an AFE. You know, so step in. And he grabbed forceps and pulled the baby out. But he didn't know this patient. We had a full board. We had 12 patients. He didn't know which one this was. So it's really important to let your OB know kind of which patient this is and what's going on. Just a really quick, concise boop, boop, boop kind of, this is the situation. She's complete. She's plus two. She's a multip. Pull that baby out. You know what I mean?
I also want to make a point, because Linda, I forget that people don't always have the things that we have, because you mentioned calling OBET. So at Vanderbilt, OBET is the OB emergency team. And when you call OBET in labor and delivery, you get attendings. So midwives and physicians, usually you get residents, because all the residents need to be in on whatever this experience is. You get a charge nurse, a resource nurse, as well as NICU and anesthesia. So if something is going down in the context of like a delivery or something postpartum, you get all the right people at once. Now, the caveat to that is, it is not a rapid team. So you are not getting like a critical care NP, you're not getting pharmacy, you're not getting respiratory, but you are getting the important OB people to the room. So we get NICU if we need them for like, you know, neonatal support. We get anesthesia, because I was just going to mention that the next steps really in AFE have a lot to do with our anesthesia partners, because they're going to be the ones who are managing that right ventricular failure and that pulmonary hypertension, right? And they're going to be the ones with all the good the good drugs, the good vasopressors, and the things that we can give people to help correct some of those things. So getting anesthesia there is important. So I think at Vandy, we can call both, right? We can call an OBET and a rapid, but it brings a different, like two different sets of people to us. So you have to kind of think about what happens in your own environment, right? What do you have and what are your resources if something emergent happens?
Beautiful. Yeah, I agree. It's kind of overwhelming to have 30 people come running in the room, but everybody has a role and everybody has, you know, a set, you know, things that they need to do. It's really helpful. It's really great to have anesthesia there at your side.
That's another reason to do those simulations, I'm thinking, because, you know, we talked about having not only remembering how to do good CPR and how to get, you know, the calls made where they need to be made, but also just your team working together and understanding how many different roles there are and practicing that is really important.
Yeah, this is a big one, you know, compared to like shoulder dystocia or a postpartum hemorrhage, mm-hmm. this involves a whole nother set of rapid, you know, response team members. So it's sometimes we all don't know what the other person's doing, you know, so it's really nice to maybe do a sim and really kind of gain that sense of insight into how this all can really function really well, but it does take 12 people. It really does.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to make sure, I mean, we know a lot in the hemorrhage literature and we've talked about TXA and how great it is. This is the time to pull in that TXA really quickly because it can help with the subsequent hemorrhage from the DIC. So it seems like pretty much everyone has that available now. But that was definitely a key component with AFE that was a little bit different than just our routine postpartum hemorrhages, but important to think about here.
Linda, I was going to ask you too, and because I've been reading some case reports and it looks to me like a lot of AFEs present differently in terms of rhythm. So I was reading a recent case report that talked about the patient was in PEA, which, you know, looks different than somebody who's in, you know, pulseless VTAC or VFib because the management is different, right, in PEA. What has been your experience in terms of like cardiac rhythm?
You know, I haven't really seen a lot of cardiac rhythms just because they were pretty unsuccessful in, like, we delivered babies on all three of them. Like, we did a perimortem on the first one. She did not survive. They were unsuccessful resuscitations until they got the patient to the unit. So the one woman died and the other two got to the unit. And I don't know what their rhythms were once they got up there. But they were pretty unstable when they were down here on our floor.
Mm-hmm. We don't have people on tele in labor and delivery normally. Like normal healthy women don't need tele during labor and delivery. So we don't really see, like, I think what they're, you know, unless they're in the OR, right? I think that looks different.
We don't hang pressors. I mean, we use such a limited amount of, you know, our beta blockers and hydral. So once somebody needs pressors, they're usually off the floor. So we don't really see a lot of that in terms of having that kind of experience. Yeah. So I don't know what happened for the two that went to the unit for sure.
So Kara, do you want to talk a little bit about AOK? And then I think we can lead into some of the other, I can also talk about it, but we can talk about some of the different like simulations that are available and ways to get prepared and like learning resources.
Yeah, sure. So in the literature, there's a relatively, relatively new. It seems like it's been in the last several years and certainly more so in case reports about using this AOK protocol, and it consists of using atropine 1 milligram to block the vagal reflex and then the subsequent hypotension that happens. It also reverses the pulmonary artery spasm that occurs. And then Zofran or ondansetron 8 milligrams to combat the acute right heart failure and the cardiogenic shock that happens, and then ketorolac or toradol 15 to 30 milligrams to manage the coagulopathy and its early aggressive management of the bleeding and use of the mass transfusion protocols and so forth. So AOK standing for atropine, ondansetron, and ketorolac.
I love it.
Did you guys use that? I'm wondering.
Yeah, that would have been what we did in the OB unit itself was mostly products, right? So We usually do, the products are usually 1-to-1-to-1. So they get packed red blood cells, 6 platelets, and 6 FFP. And then if they need TXA or cryo, we'll give that. Like if their fibrinogen is less than 150, we can give cryoprecipitate. But basically, it's just supportive measures for those kind of products. And then when they go to the unit, that's when we would see the AOK being used. I didn't see any of those used in the room. It was mostly just to try to get the bleeding controlled. We were trying to put a Bakri in. We didn't have the JADA system back then. Just trying to get her bleeding under control while they were continuing to do CPR. So it was mostly supportive measures for DIC. And then once she was stabilized and went to the unit, she probably did get AOK, which is great. I love knowing that.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating because it really gets at those underlying causes of what's going on. And so thinking about that, the vagal reaction that happens. And interestingly, with the Zofran, it's intended to block our serotonin receptors. So I mentioned earlier serotonin's involved. That's fascinating. And then the Toradol blocks our thromboxane production. And so in DIC, we know that all of these things are happening, and each of the different components, the A, O, and K, are working in very different ways to help slow the bleeding that happens with DIC, which is really fascinating.
Point I was going to make about some of these, the things that we've been talking about are like, not all of these protocols are adopted everywhere. So AOK is something that we find in the literature, but the ACOG doesn't recommend. And the reason the reason that they don't recommend it at this time is just that there's not enough literature. And here's the problem. It occurs so infrequently, it's really difficult. It's a really difficult protocol to study in terms of how do we get good literature that supports a protocol, right? You have to have like a lot of events to collect information about, right? And what we're hoping is we're not having a lot of AFEs. But so AOK is out there, but there are professional organizations that don't believe in, you know, standard and or routine use of those protocols.
I kind of hope that we don't get to standard use of those things just for the reasons that you mentioned. But I couldn't find it in well-established recommendations or guidelines, not on up-to-date, any of those different things. But there is quite a bit of information about case reports and case studies that have been shared, different posters at research symposiums and so forth, because it is being used. And it seems like they're having better outcomes with the use of the AOK protocol.
Yeah. I also want to put on a list of differentials of things that you're trying to also rule out when we're talking about AFE. And I think maybe I should have put this in earlier, but things like septic shock, right? Does your patient have a fever? Because if they have a fever, it's not AFE. And I'm going to talk about that in a second. Do they have some sort of cardiogenic shock, right? Are they at risk for cardiomyopathy, right? Is this a peripartum or postpartum cardiomyopathy versus an AFE? Is this anaphylactic shock from, you know, drug use, product use, any of those things, right? Do they have a PE, like Linda was talking about earlier? So do they have an aortic dissection? So I think that there are a lot of other things that go on this differential list. And I want to be clear about the actual diagnostic criteria, right, for AFE. And you need to have all of these things, right, present. So sudden onset of arrest or hypotension, like Linda was saying, with a systolic under 90 and evidence of respiratory compromise, documented overt DIC, right? And there's ways to score DIC based on platelet count, PT, and or fibrinogen. 3 is clinical onset during labor or within 30 minutes of placental delivery. And then the 4th thing is absence of fever, which is what I just said. So when you're thinking about, like, as we talk about this, like remembering that those are the big things that we're looking for when we talk about AFE.
Missy, I was going to add, also this can happen during an abortion. And it can also happen during like an amnioinfusion or any kind of disruption of that amniotic fluid. So I just wanted to bring up the fact that there are some midwives that might not work in the intrapartum setting, and they might be working more like in Planned Parenthood, in one of those lovely states where you can still practice terminations. And it can happen during abortion. So it's an important thing to be aware of. And I'm sure everybody's used to using an AED, but certainly if you're not, that's a really important piece as to how to put one on, how to read it, when to shock, all that comes into play, right?
That's such a good point.
I feel like I remember learning, maybe it was like a nursing school or something, of that sudden decompression of the uterus could cause it to be more likely to occur at that time. It thought that amniotic fluid might get into the maternal circulation with that sudden decompression.
You know, I love that thought, Kara, because isn't it interesting that out of the three that I've witnessed, two of them were pushing. So yeah. It makes me wonder what Valsalva and just those change in osmotic pressures might have forced it. It's an interesting thought. I don't know why I had two patients that were complete and pushing with AFEs, but that's when it occurred. And it's I'm very mindful of that fact. It's very interesting. I can't quite get away from how those are similar and what that might have caused in terms of pushing that debris up into that maternal circulation, right?
One of the published case studies actually talks about a patient who is getting an amnio infusion and experienced AFE. That's fascinating.
Yeah, because here we are changing the osmotic pressure, right? We're messing with things. And, you know, I wonder if there would have been a connection years ago with, you know, when we used to do amnio infusions for meconium to thin out meconium, you know, were there more AFEs? I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't know what the literature says.
Fascinating.
I don't know. It is.
So when Linda mentioned the best thing that we can do for ourselves is to be prepared, right? There are all kinds of, I think, training resources. And Linda, I'm going to ask what you think. I've got one, and then you can tell me if you know of another. There is actually a website called amnioticfluidembolism.org. It's insane. It has a complete like simulation module for AFE, everything you need to know. It's like there's a self-paced course plus a sim toolkit, and it's free. And I am all about free, and I'm all about high quality education. And if they're calling their website amniotic fluid embolism, it makes me believe that this is quality information.
Well, it's from the AFE Foundation, actually. So yes, it's a really good organization. And I love it. Everyone can take this course for 3 CEs, which is, I feel like, quite a bit. And it looks like it's really nicely paced and not overwhelming, not scary. But I love the idea of the simulation toolkit as well for all the things that you mentioned, Linda.
Yeah, I saw that on the website and I thought that was interesting because I was looking that there was an AFE registry. And I, you know, when you have an AFE to report it, because we need to kind of keep track of what's out there, what's happening, and what the numbers look like. But then I saw that there was a training program, a little simulation toolkit. It was pretty cool. And who wouldn't be interested in that, you know?
Yeah, the other really amazing thing that the AFE Foundation does is provide support to people that experience AFE and their family. And I think we should probably mention, Missy, some of the long-term effects that people can experience after an AFE. And you sort of started on this a little bit earlier, Linda, but it can be mild to severe neurologic impairment, memory loss, temporary or permanent heart damage. They could end up with a hysterectomy. I think quite a few of these individuals do. Stroke, Sheehan syndrome, particularly if there was aggressive management of that endometrium, GI issues, pelvic floor dysfunction, nerve pain, and kidney dysfunction are all really long-term effects. And then one of the most important being mental health effects after this experience.
Yeah, I think the trauma is something that women carry with them for the rest of their lives. And one of the things as midwives that we can tell them at least is that this does not increase their risk in a subsequent pregnancy. So that maybe might be a little bit helpful that they're not necessarily at any increased risk for another AFE when they have another baby. Although I'm sure in labor, they're going to have, you know, some feelings of remembering, you know, that terrible incident. At least some people don't remember much of it, but certainly family members do.
Well, the family members, and you mentioned it, I want to touch on this for a second, but being the provider, that experiences that traumatic event as well. And I think you mentioned a debrief that would certainly be really, really important right after the event, not waiting like a week or two later, I'm guessing.
Yeah, whenever at Vanderbilt, whenever we have emergencies, we debrief, but we did at Parkland as well. And I think it's really helpful to be positive in the debrief. It shouldn't be about criticism. It should be about, thank you so much for getting that C-section tray so we could do a peri, you know, just get that baby out as quickly as possible and so forth and so on. What really helped, what might have been better, but certainly it's not a place for criticism. It's just a place for support and thanks and, you know, maybe even a, you know, holding hands and passing around some thoughts for everybody to be, all those physicians up in the ICU to be the best they can be. So one of the things we did was we met 3 days later, the team that I was working with that night. And because we had to go on and run the rest of the board that night. And we were all kind of in shock for the rest of the 11 hours that we had for that night shift. But we met 3 days later and we all had breakfast and we all had our moments of tears and supporting one another and thanks. And it was really something that brought us all together and made us closer mm-hmm. as coworkers. And yeah, it was just, it's something we bond over for sure. And it was really helpful to do that.
I think too, that like when Kara was talking about the PTSD, like mental part of it, that like we have talked to patients who experienced AFE, that ones who have survived, and they don't remember most of it. And so a lot of it comes around to like their family members experiencing that and what effect that has on them. So I think making sure that just supports are in place for everyone involved, not just the patient. The whole thing. This is like the craziest topic ever, but it's been such a good discussion of, you know, what can we do to save women's lives in OB emergencies? And, you know, a lot of midwives are working in places that aren't as well resourced as we are, Linda. Like, we are lucky that we have what we have and that we can call all the people and have them be at the bedside. But when these things happen in rural settings or in settings that are, you know, community hospitals, like, this looks really different for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. And think about actually like Doctors Without Borders and people who are in undeveloped nations that are delivering babies in very remote, low access areas where but really don't even have blood. You know what I mean? They don't have any kind of blood products to give a patient. So we are so blessed. And I think of that every day, how blessed we are that I can just turn and look at you, Missy, and say, come on in here.
Yeah. I mean, even when we talk about, when you and I talk about OBET, we just are like, oh, we just call an OBET. And people are like, you mean you have a whole team of people who comes? Yeah, we do. We're that lucky. But honestly, I think sometimes when you work in a place like this, we're a nice model of what care can look like when you need to be able to assemble something quickly, right? We have a lot of good protocols in place, and our OBET team is something that I absolutely appreciate, that is very unlike other places that I have worked as well. And I've worked in a lot of different places. I started my career in a community hospital, and I can't imagine what our response might have looked like. We had a lot of smart doctors and a lot of smart nurses, but this situation looks different in a rural hospital and a community hospital than it does at someplace like Parkland or someplace like Vanderbilt.
Yeah, no, I can't say enough about working at a level 3 hospital. It's just, you just feel so protected and so supported, right? I wanted to mention, I don't know if y'all have ever done this. Have you ever done also the ALSO course, ALSO, Advanced Life Support and Obstetrics?
I've not done it, but I've heard such great things about it. But yeah, being prepared for those emergencies.
Yeah, it's a really great course. It's actually run by family practice docs who do obstetrics. But I did the course in Albuquerque a few years ago, and I was really hoping to try to get one, a group to come to Nashville. It's a really great course. It's like a sim class all day long for 2 days. It's really wonderful. And they talk a little bit about PEs and AFEs. So it's really helpful because they're always focused on resuscitation skills. It's just another thought for people with their education and where they might be in terms of needing to do a sim class and making that happen.
Kara should tag them in our social media posts, and maybe they'll pay attention to our podcast episode and send somebody to Nashville for us.
Yeah. Well, it does sound like you guys have an incredible place. And Linda, thank you so much for sharing your stories, because it sounds like you've had a really rich career with a lot of great experiences, and then a few really just incredible ones that some of us have never experienced.
And, you know, I pray that you never experience it, of course. And I pray you know, and that if you do, that you feel really well prepared. But thank you so much, y'all, for having me on here. It's just been a really wonderful experience. And I love that you're out there educating the world. It just makes such a difference.
Well, thanks for joining us for the Engaged Midwife podcast. We can't wait to talk to you again.
Take care.